This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes Madeline Boccaro to discuss her book, In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today I'm joined by Madeline Boccaro, the author of In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. Madeline, welcome.
Thank you, Nate.
And so this book isn't a straight biography. It's a little different. It's more of an artistic appreciation. And I'd like to thank you for that, because Yoko, to me, is somebody who doesn't get a fair shot. She's maligned and misunderstood. And I think this book is an excellent corrective to a lot of that misunderstanding. Can you tell me a little bit about the concept of the book and what it is, if not a conventional biography?
Oh, well, it's a 558 pages, actually, of individual stories that I had written about Yoko's journey as an artist and her love story with John over the years. And just to describe her artworks and her songs and an album one at a time to different fans and friends. And then I realized that I had enough material for a book.
And it's a fine book, and it collects your impressions of her different art projects, albums, conceptual shows, concert performances, and a little bit about her relationship with John. And I think your point about not trusting books written by critics and being an advocate of books written by fans, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because that's important to me and something I agree with as well.
Sure, because a lot of people, actually, I saw a Spanish person was looking at my book and she said, oh, can I have a copy of this? I can read this. It's simply written. I can read the words. You know, when I'm reading words I don't understand in a book about the Ramones or something, you know, I don't want to read that. I want to live it. I want to experience it. I want to remember it. And I don't want to be compared to other aspects of history. I mean, Yoko is Yoko. She works in her own vacuum. So anyway, I think Yoko is very positive and conscious. And I like to speak about the things, the simple way she states how we can all work together and heal together. And a lot of people are finding the book very, very helpful, aside from it being about Yoko. And you can like read each chapter as a short story and skip around with all individual stories, you know.
Yeah, I found that quite helpful and useful for me, since I was interested in the music side of things more so than the art. So I read the whole thing through once, and then it was really easy to dive back into the specific chapters about the music. But now I want to talk about Yoko's background, because I think a lot of people don't understand how unique her background is and exactly how privileged she was as a child. Can you tell us about Yoko's family, both her mother's side and her father's side, and how she was raised?
Sure. So I intertwined her intriguing family history. It's incredible, into the story of when John meets her parents in Japan for the first time. So her mother was a Yasuda. They were like the Rockefellers of Japan at the time. You know, they were Buddhist, and her father's side were Christian. And many of her relatives were extremely wealthy aristocrats and artists, musicians, history makers, and some even descended from nobility. And John identified with a particular story of her great-grandfather, who's a banking billionaire. And he saw a picture of the guy, and he said, oh, this guy is me. And, you know, because don't say that, he was assassinated. So it's really incredible.
Yeah, that is an interesting twist. And you know, Yoko's never made any bones about her belief in supernatural forces and zodiac and psychics and everything. So that's a big part of the story as well. And that was a big part of John Lennon's life with her as well. And I want to drill down into her specific musical background, because, you know, a lot of people, particularly Beatles fans who were confronted with Yoko for the first time at, say, Live Peace in Toronto or early Plastic Ono Band shows, a lot of people have the mistaken notion that she was an amateur. And anybody who's tried to emulate her vocal stylings will figure out pretty quick that it's not something that an amateur can do or even really attempt. So could you tell us about her musical education?
Sure. So since childhood, she was familiar with written musical scores. She learned pitch and harmony and how to score music. And one of her homeworks that she always talks about is that she had to listen to the sounds of the day and transfer them into musical notes. So she had that perfect pitch, and she knew all that, and that it all made her realize that the composer wasn't the only one that can interpret a work, and that was her whole premise towards art, you know, giving instructions so that people could find their own meaning and complete the work. And, you know, she was into 12-tone composers and Middle Eastern and Indian music and folk songs. And, you know, they asked her about her favorite music once, and she said, I know, I can't say it's Bebop Lula. You know, she liked all the abstract composers.
And she was also a pianist who liked to sit down and play Bach and Beethoven and Debussy just to relax, famously inspiring John's song Because, which was based on her playing with Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. But there's one technique in particular that you describe her using in the book that was interesting to me, which is something you call the Hitai technique that came from Kabuki theater. Can you talk a little bit about that, how she applied it and how it, you know, what's Kabuki theater and how that technique was something that was applicable when Yoko first started jamming with rock and roll bands with John Lennon?
Sure. Well, I have a chapter called Queen of the Scream, and it explains where it comes from and how. Hitai is from Kabuki theater. I think it was more of a subconscious influence, because she doesn't walk around saying I was influenced by Kabuki theater. But there's another form called Enka, and there's Okinawan folk music that she's got little elements of, and traditional Japanese children's songs and pop songs, you know, it all like nostalgic flavored melodies. And, you know, she has a lot of melodies as well. So, and it's all Japanese influence. There's an entire chapter about the Japanese heart of her work. You know, she revers the aesthetics and spirituality and the reverence for invisible things and for nature. And this is all imbued in her work. And she sees the world that's like not just three-dimensional, but six-dimensional. She's not bound by any conformist musical techniques. You know, she broke through all the barriers, really.
And let's tell me a little bit about her first husband, Toshi Ichinanagi, because he is one of the most famous composers in post-war Japanese history, both avant-garde and traditional Western music and traditional Japanese music. How did she hook up with him? And also, she collaborated with him to some extent as well.
Oh, yeah. So Toshi, of course, they're kind of the same age, and he's Japanese. And they got together in 1956, living in New York City. And they both embrace the modern Western world and their Japanese culture altogether. And they each were classically trained at a young age. And Toshi was interested in 12 tone composition, but he was at Juilliard and they didn't have classes in that. So he just became a virtuoso pianist and a composer. And he was an associate of John Cage, and Cage turned him on to avant-garde music. And Yoko and Toshi attended Cage's seminars in New York City at the New School. And they toured Japan with Cage, who was influenced by Buddhism and Japanese art as well. And they collaborated with Toshio Miyazumi. He was one of the first avant-garde artists in Japan. And also Yoko designed his album cover with the cloud on it. So yeah, Toshi was great. And they remained friendly. You know, he once defended her art when she was heavily criticized in a Japanese publication. And he said, you know, critics should understand that artists have an original language that can't be understood by existing senses. And he considered Yoko to have metaphysical rules. So he got her, you know, he really understood her.
And let's hear a little bit of Yoko. This is Yoko singing a traditional Japanese folk song called Sakura. And this is from the Mike Douglas Show when John and Yoko were regular guests in the early 70s. Yayoi no sora wa miwatasu kagiri kasumi ka kumo ka asahi ni mio sakura sakura. And that was Yoko Ono singing a Japanese folk song called Sakura on the Mike Douglas Show in the early 1970s. And I picked that one because I wanted people to understand that Yoko can sing in a conventional sense, and particularly when you hear her singing Japanese and she's not dealing with the additional handicap of the English accent. English is her second language. It's should be obvious to anyone that she can sing from hearing that.
Sure. And yeah.
And I'm just pushing back on that just because I've read so many rock critics and fans, you know, assailing Yoko's music without understanding that she is actually a trained technician. At the same time, coming from a background of classical music, traditional and classical Japanese music, and avant-garde classical music, which is different from 12-tone classical music, which she was also a student of, plus she collaborated with Ornette Coleman in free jazz. So it's almost like Yoko was made in a lab to blow the mind of Beatles fans with all this stuff that they had no concept was going on in the musical world outside of John and Paul. And I'm a huge Beatles fan, but you know, there's a lot more to the world than She Loves You and Love Me Do. And Yoko brought so much of it to the table. It just really freaked people out massively. And now I want to ask about her go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I can't find any contradictory statements because people always say, oh, she knew about the Beatles. But throughout her life, through John's life, I mean, she's always truthful and consistent about not knowing them. And there's a quote in that Peter Brown book, The Love You Make. You know, the Beatles were reminiscing about their Shea Stadium concerts, and Yoko was oblivious. She said, what were you doing at a baseball stadium? You know, and they said, well, we played two sold-out concerts there. And she said, oh, well, you know, she started telling them about the events that she staged that year, which, of course, they had no idea about. So, you know, she was oblivious to the fact that they were the biggest band in the world.
Yeah, and that's something that people find very hard to believe. But if you know people that are focused on their scene and doing their thing and are very busy, and why would she be paying attention to pop music? She's playing on stage with John Cage and, exactly. You know, Lamonte Young, who's an enormous influence on the Velvet Underground, but also kind of the father of minimalism, which is the classical style that kind of brought Western classical music back into popular favor in the early 70s. So yet another very big deal. But her marriage to Toshi falls apart in the early 60s after they had toured together, and she was actually in a hospital after having a breakdown when her second husband, Anthony Cox, actually tracked her down in the hospital because he had become so fascinated with her work. Can you tell me a little bit about that and their relationship?
Yeah, well, Tony was, he was a fan, I guess, you know, early on. And he found her in the hospital and he got her out and he became her promoter in a way. And they had a young daughter together and they traveled and did work in New York and events and happenings. And he helped her with her cut piece and the bagism and all the things she staged, trapping the lions in Trafalgar Square. He was instrumental in getting her the show at Indica Gallery where she met John. So yeah, he was a big fan in the beginning.
And let's talk a little bit about the conceptual art. I don't want to get too into that because I'm more interested in the musical side of it, but I think understanding what a conceptual artist is and that Yoko was very much a pioneering conceptual artist of the 20th century. And her book, Grapefruit, which she wrote when she was 19, is just incredibly dense and packed with tons of ideas, several of which have since been implemented. Can you tell us a little about Grapefruit and the concept? What is conceptual art and how did Yoko manifest it?
Okay, so Grapefruit was published in 1964. She's made 500 copies. And she really, it was just therapeutic for her. She had been through the war, you know, evacuated from her home as a child. And she was really a fragile person. And she wanted to communicate. And the way she communicated was just writing these little scenarios for people to complete in their minds. And sadly, she achieved in that book, reading it. In fact, like some people say, reading some of the chapters in my book are like reading Grapefruit at length, because she's just got so many incredible thoughts and messages, really like self-help messages. And Grapefruit is really fun. She didn't want it to be like a, like we were saying, of critics writing these long drawn out theories. And yeah, you know, she wanted a book like that. She wanted it to be something you could just read and digest and work with in your own life.
And that's something I think that has really baffled a lot of people that are trying to deal with Yoko Ono's work, and they've just never seen anything like it. And it's just pretty much, I've found that if you just take it at face value, she means what she says what she means, and she's planting ideas in your head and, you know, think these thoughts, experiments through, and sometimes take the actions that she describes and things will happen. She was also associated with a group called Fluxus and performed, with them, at their Carnegie and at the Carnegie Recital Hall, which isn't the main hall, but it's a smaller venue connected to Carnegie Hall in 1965. She performed Cut Piece there. Tell us a little about Fluxus and Yoko's relationship with them.
George McInnes is the founder of Fluxus, and he founded it on the idea, well, it was his disdain for conventional art, basically. And it was an amalgam of experimental artists and working in various media. And he was the first to create kind of a cooperative artist building, which lent the term co-op. And he gave them artists the chance to have communal living in New York affordably. And that area where he did this was soon to be known as Soho, which is south of Houston Street. And he founded this Flux House Cooperative. And all the artists flocked to him. Of course, he ended up meeting Yoko. He gave her her first exhibition at his gallery. He has this gallery called AG in summer of 61. And it was in the dark because he couldn't afford electricity and the gallery was closed eventually. But yeah, they were just poor artists who got together and formed this movement. Well, he called it a movement. Yoko didn't like the idea of movement. She just thought, you know, we should just all work together.
And another collaborative project she did around this time was the Chamber Street Concert Series. And these were a series of concerts in her loft in that same part of town with Lamonte Young, who I mentioned before, the progenitor of minimalism, and also electronic composer Richard Mayfield performed, as well as Yoko. Tell us a little bit about the Chamber Street Concert Series.
Okay, so those are from December 1960 to June 61. And, you know, Yoko was kind of dissatisfied with the attitude of the avant-garde. She felt they were elitist. And she was surviving by teaching Japanese arts in the city, and she put her art aside. But the Chamber Street concerts were in Tribeca, where artists started living and working there. And she was amongst the first people to do this. But the context, basically, is John was still in the Beatles with Pete Best on the drums, you know, when this was happening. And, you know, when the Beatles first came to America, she was staging her own events in Tokyo. She published Grapefruit, and she did Cut Piece in Japan and New York, and the Carnegie Hall concert, and all this, you know, was before that. So she found this five-floor walk-up at Chamber Street, and there were very few places in the city at the time where unknown artists could perform, and, you know, either downtown or at the Carnegie Recital Hall. So she converted this loft into a performance space, and it was co-promoted by Lamont Young, and he worked with electronic drones. You know, he composed music with vibrations, basically. And she remembered the exact moment she thought of doing the concerts, and she sensed the future significance of it. And so she was in a hurry to begin, and she didn't have time to buy furniture. And so everyone was sitting around on orange crates. But it was just really primitive, but really futuristic as well.
Yeah, and also I think historically immensely significant because of not only the impact on the avant-garde classical world, but also through the rock and roll world. And I want to play one of Yoko's first collaborations with John Lennon now. And then when I come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the connection between Yoko and Lamonte Young and what they were doing and the birth of alternative rock from the Velvet Underground to Sonic Youth, which Yoko and Lamonte Young are kind of the grandparents of, I would say. But this is Don't Worry, Kyoko. Mom is Only Looking for Her Hand in the Snow, recorded with the Plastic Ono Band. And that was Yoko Ono with the Plastic Ono Band doing Don't Worry, Kyoko with Eric Clapton and John Lennon on guitars, Klaus Voormann on bass, and is that Ringo or Andy White on drums? I cannot remember. But that is the unfiltered – excuse me, did you have the answer on that one?
Don't Worry, Kyoko? No, it's not Andy White, not Ringo.
Yeah, okay. It's Andy White. And but that is like that's the stuff that freaked out the Beatles fans. And this was the first Yoko I was exposed to. And I can remember as a little kid seeing this song on TV and watching the way my older brothers, who were big, you know, Willie Nelson fans and Cat Stevens fans, freaking out and watching the faces in the crowd at the Toronto Live Peace Festival and watching the hippies just losing it. And I immediately gleefully loved this stuff and searched for years to try to track this down. It wasn't until I was probably four, I think I was six when I saw that on TV. And it took me, you know, another 10, 11 years before I found the album that's on. And I've just always loved that. To me, it's right there with Captain Beefheart and other experiments in late 60s music that just presage punk rock. And really, I love the confrontationality of it. And I understand a lot of Yoko fans like to de-emphasize that stuff because they want to say, oh no, she actually wrote a lot more conventional songs and she did dance music and she's got more popular stuff. But to me, I love all that stuff too, but Don't Worry, Kyoko.
Yeah,
is absolutely one of my favorite songs of all time. And I'm not kidding. I'm dead serious about that.
Mine too. And it's got, you know, like if you, yeah, I grew up to learn. And when I heard on the radio, the Everly Brothers, Wake Up Little Susie, I'm like, that's the riff, you know, that's Hilary Kyoko. And even like, Yoko says about Sean, she's like, my son's friends are always exchanging all these CDs that they make privately and that they think are so far out. And she's like, I just have to shut my mouth. I'm not going to say that's like what I used to do. You know, I just say, great, that's cool. You know, but it's getting to that point now where people are catching up to her. So yeah, that's the best.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's important to understand about that is that all of the musicians were basically jumping in at the deep end because the band hadn't rehearsed very much, if at all, especially when they first performed in Toronto. I think they put together a set list on the plane as they were flying over there. So it's really heavy on the stuff, the material that John Lennon knew, which was 50s rock and roll. And yeah, that Everly Brothers lick as the basis of Don't Worry, Kyoko, it makes sense when you hear them side by side. But when I first heard that slide guitar riff, it just sounded like the most insane, you know, way ahead of its time sort of punk rock noise thing. In fact, yeah. A punk rock band called the Child Molesters did a cover of that. That was the first time I found it on record after hunting for it for years. And, and loved that, you know, Child Molesters version of it. And then, you know, when I found the original version, it was very exciting. So, and, you know, and Yoko is also thrown in the deep end with very little background in rock and roll and never having played with Marshall amps and drum kits, and you know, and she's having to go toe to toe with this rock band with just her voice, and it's amazing. And I also think that people don't get that her singing education, she was familiar with scales that had more notes than the Western well-tempered clavier set of notes that Bach boiled us down to, and so she's hitting what to her are notes, but to the Western ear sound like she's missing the notes. So, I mean, I think a lot of
She says that John kind of gave her back the body with rock and roll. She was all ethereal, you know, avant-garde stuff. But she always says he woke me up from my mind game, which was really healthy because like surrealism was natural for her. And she always described emotions in a symbolic way or screaming. And, one of my favorite things that she says is that, you know, if you listen to some of my past records, you'll experience songs that touch your delicate nerves, but the harsh ones are really my signature sound. I wanted to break the sound barrier with those sounds, and the world needs to listen to our scream. So I just like thought that was really sums her up in a way. And I asked her once, you know, what can you do with a scream that you can't say with words? And she says it's just extremely expressive of our emotional life, which we always censor. And people don't want to hear women screaming. They want to hear a pretty song. And that's the male society's idea, you know. And also she likens, you know, her song Kiss, Kiss, Kiss. She's like, people feel it's less natural to hear the sound of woman's lovemaking than the sound of a Concorde killing the atmosphere. You know, but she thinks that both sides are really needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was also interesting to read that some of her vocalizations, particularly in the song Why, were inspired by having overheard a servant giving birth in the mansion that she grew up in. And that was a classic case of the parents knowing this birth was coming and telling her to stay away from the servants' quarters. And of course, she makes a beeline for the servants' quarters to hear what's going on. And, you know, that marked her. And it's just such a powerful expression of women's trauma. It's just, to me, it's one of my absolute favorite pieces of music of all time. And the thing that made me a Yoko fan for life. But let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsor. When we come back, let's talk about how she met John Lennon and kind of their relationship.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And so Yoko Ono actually was charged by John Cage with approaching the Beatles to get some of their songwriting manuscripts for a project that he was working on, collecting manuscripts from various composers. She initially approached Paul McCartney, who didn't want to part with his sheets, but thought John Lennon might be more open to it and referred her to him. But they actually first meet at the Indica Gallery in London. Pretty famous story, but go ahead and give your version of it for those who don't know it.
Okay, so yeah, it was November 1966. The owner of the gallery, John Dunbar, he was Marianne Faithfull's husband at the time, he brings John to Yoko's exhibition on the night before the opening. It's called Unfinished Paintings and Objects. So it's at Indica Gallery. So basically, you know, Yoko's older. She's 8 years older than John, and John had just turned 26. She was in her second marriage to Tony when they had a daughter together. And she was struggling as an artist in Tokyo and New York. So she came to London, and she just felt like, she described it as a shimmer in the air. She just felt the electricity. So it was in the basement of Indica Books, and it was in the center of swinging London. And Paul McCartney's girlfriend, Jane Asher, had a brother, Peter, and he was a co-owner along with Barry Miles. And it was in Mason's Yard in Mayfair, on a hip area, a little cul-de-sac, and near the St. James Club where Hendrix played and other greats. And, you know, so McCartney was a big supporter of the gallery, and he introduced Yoko to John because she had asked him for some manuscripts, and John, you know, Paul never parted with any of that stuff. And so, yeah, Paul was like a little jealous because he thought he was the avant-garde one. You know, he loved all these artists and was into this gallery. But John became wildly avant-garde because he was so constricted living in Weybridge, and his wife didn't understand how free he wanted to be. So he kind of beat Paul to the punch in, you know, the avant-garde world. So, yeah, it was like after the Beatles' final concert, you know, they had recently released Yesterday and Today and recording Revolver, and they were just about to begin the sessions for Sgt. Pepper, and this is when John and Yoko met. So Dunbar told John that this avant-garde artist would be staging a happening. So John, of course, thinks, oh, great orgy, you know, but of course, he just sees this little woman in her long black hair arranging these weird objects for her exhibition. And Yoko was a little mad that Dunbar brought somebody there. She was just like busy getting it ready. But she said, you know, she saw them standing in front of her exhibit, this blank canvas. And she's like, John's looking at it like it's the most important painting in the world. And she's like, oh, this guy looks nice, you know. So the first thing she did was hand John a card that said breathe. And he's like, okay. And then he saw the ladder, white ladder, up to the ceiling with a magnifying glass hanging from it. And this painting on the ceiling had this tiny words that said, yes. And that was just their way to heaven, basically. And that was it from there on. He said, you know, everything was anti this, anti that, and this was something positive. So I was in, you know. So that was how they kind of met.
And the two of them correspond then and build a friendship for the next year and a half or so. And ultimately, one night, Cynthia Lennon is away from home and Yoko comes to Lennon's house, and they consummate their relationship and record the Unfinished Music Two Virgins album. Tell us about that collaboration.
Okay, so yeah, about 18 months after they met, they finally get together because she had been in Paris and London, and you know, she was trying to avoid it, actually. She didn't want to get involved with someone. She just wanted to do her work. But she always believes in that unfinished concept. And she said she got it from Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. And she always says that she feels like Mozart at the end of that film, where he's writing and writing, trying to finish, and she's trying to do that in every aspect of her life, but everything seems like unfinished. So it was their first recording together. It was a sound collage. They thought it sounds in the mind of the listener, not really in the grooves of a record. So it's really just the sound of two artists falling in love and noodling around with tank loops and wordless vocals and having a sort of rebirth, but on drugs, of course. And they did the naked album cover as like the first nude selfie, I guess. And they shocked the world in this birthday feast there. And Yoko laughed because John took the picture with a timer and cleared everybody out of the room so I could do it in secret, and then the whole world sees it. That's their humor, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting in the book, she talks about how Lennon kind of brought the humor into their work and their collaboration. And it's, I think, easy for a lot of people to see her as some sort of Svengali who lured John Lennon away from the Beatles and got him doing all this crazy stuff. But it's pretty clear when you really parse out their collaborations that John Lennon was as crazy as anybody ever and was in a way using Yoko to help him break free of the incredibly constraining Beatles public image and get back to being, you know, that Lennon, which is what every mother in Liverpool called him as they told their kids to stay away from him. Like, he had mastered, you know, communications to the level that he could become, could co-create the most popular band in the history of the world. And so to me, it's very clear that he architected all of his actions with Yoko. I mean, I don't think that they had any idea what the reactions would be, but I think they were very conscious, and Lennon in particular was very conscious, that he was breaking down his public image and killing Beatle John so that John Lennon could live.
Right, right. And there's this amusing clip of like outtakes from Two Virgins, and you hear, you know, she's going to go crazy with her vocalization, and John is jokingly counting her down. He's like, okay, we're the 1-2, 1-2, and she's laughing. It's just hilarious. They had this great, great rapport and humor that they just clicked.
And tell us about the other unfinished music albums, Life with the Lions and the Wedding Album that they did together.
So Wedding Album is based upon, well, you know, it's all silliness, really, but it's hilarious. Sean actually put out a repackaging of it recently, and including all the exact replicas of the stuff included inside. And he's actually playing it in the video and kind of laughing at how crazy it really is. But, you know, they're calling each other's names and they're playing radio snippets, and they're just experimenting. And the moments of silence is the cool thing. I think that's kind of an homage to John Cage. I always wonder if she had to pay him royalties on the silence, because that was his thing.
That would be fair enough. And Life with the Lions, though, has a much more poignant aspect to it.
Well, she had a miscarriage and they were recording it in the hospital there. So, and they have a baby's heartbeat on the record. So,
yeah, and you can hear it fading away to silence, and it's a really for anybody who's ever lost a child like that, it's a very powerful and sad thing.
Yeah, people don't understand. They just continue to bash her. They sent her voodoo dolls and awful, awful stuff that she had to endure, which, you know, it's going to be the focus on her life story in the end, you know, the prejudice, the racial stuff, the feminist stuff. But basically, she just looked upon it all. It hurt, you know, but she looked upon it as a blip in her life. She just continued as a blinders on. She just did what she had to do compared to the scope of her whole 89 years, you know. It's just a part of it to her.
Yeah. And let's hear our next song snippet. This is a song called Mrs. Lennon that Alex Chilton, a big star, later based his song Holocaust on these chord changes.
Mrs. Lennon. Checking the sky to see if there's no cloud. There's no cloud. Oh, then I guess it must be all right. Mrs.
And that was Mrs. Lennon from the Fly album, which was the same album that the version of Don't Worry Kyoko we played earlier was on. And to me, just a totally different side of Yoko's artistry. And I heard Holocaust by Big Star long before I heard, but I got my hands on the Fly album. I think I got a hold of Fly in 90 or 91. And as soon as I heard this, I was like, ah, Alex Chilton, you are busted. Like, this is a cold swipe of these chords.
Yeah, the Holocaust demo is even more beautiful. I love the demo. It's gorgeous. But Mrs. Lennon is one of my favorites as well. I mean, she wrote that, you know, at Chittenhurst Park, the big white home in Ascot. And she felt that life was really strange there. And it reminded her of the film Citizen Kane. And when, like, the gardener came up to her from a long distance away, and he said, "What kind of flowers do you want planted in the garden, Mrs. Lennon?" And she just felt, like, so empty and strange. So that's how... But also, there are very prescient lyrics in this song where she's like, half the world is always killed, or half the world is always dying, and, you know, neither of them ever left each other. Some of this happens in a lot of her songs. I have a whole chapter called Premonitions about this stuff. It's incredible.
Yeah, it really does seem like subconsciously she was anticipating John's fate and her fate as a widow through this stuff, and it's pretty heavy. And let's talk about this period. You know, John Lennon then famously takes Yoko along to the White Album sessions from the beginning, which, you know, disrupts the Beatles dynamic. She collaborates on Revolution 9 with John and George Harrison while McCartney's out of town. But at the same time, Paul writes a song called Hey Jude, which John and Yoko both saw as an endorsement of their relationship. Can you talk a little bit about her relationship with the Beatles and how she interacted with their creative process?
So with the Beatles, John was the one who wanted her at his side all the time. Like, she said, even to go to the bathroom. And she was so in love with him that, you know, it's okay. So she was with him, and she didn't want to intrude, but, you know, when she was asked for an opinion, she would give it. But yeah, with Hey Jude, it was really interesting because Paul's initial negativity about John being with her changed in that song, and he became selfless, and he's reassuring John to pursue a relationship with her. And he's, you know, John knew that the lyrics were speaking to him, and it's unmistakable. He says, "You found her, now go and get her, and you're waiting for someone to perform with." It's obviously those lines aren't meant for Julian, which maybe the rest of the song might be. But to me, it's really obvious when Paul sings "to let it out and let it in," which kind of refers to Yoko's first instruction to John, which is breathe. So, you know, this is Paul being really nice and saying, "Okay, I surrender, you know, go be with her." What was the other thing you asked me? Oh, about, you know, if she broke them up. I mean, obviously, she didn't break them up. In fact, she said that, you know, she felt like a tremendous wave of fear when she saw that John wanted to leave the band, because she just was concerned that her artistic freedom would be compromised if he wasn't occupied with them. And, you know, she was always an independent artist, and she never collaborated with anyone. So she felt like her power was halved. And somebody suggested that maybe John's power was doubled. And she said, "Yeah, I agree." And she was really nervous and concerned when John told her, "Now it's you and me." I mean, could you imagine? Like, a Beatle saying to you, "Oh, it's just us now." And, but she was probably more concerned, not just he was so famous or whatever, but she was concerned about sacrificing her own work and having to deal with collaborating. So.
Yeah, I mean, he's an incredibly forceful person. There's an interesting bit in the book where she's talking to one of her psychic advisors. I can't remember what the person's particular occult specialty was, but the person said that Yoko was like a wind that was roaring over the earth but was ungrounded, and that she had just met somebody who was grounded like a mountain, and that was John Lennon. Mm-hmm. I thought that was an excellent description of what they were bringing to the table, because Lennon was so wealthy and famous and used to channeling his creativity into things that drew a mass audience, and very different from what Yoko had been doing in the avant-garde scene. But let's talk a little bit about the Plastic Ono Band era. They collaborated on live shows. They played on the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, which of course wasn't released for many years. They played the live piece at Toronto show at the Toronto Rock and Roll Festival, and then come together to put out the Plastic Ono Band albums, the John Lennon Plastic Ono Band and the Yoko Ono Plastic Ono Band, which to me, if you take those two albums and mix them into a iTunes playlist or a YouTube playlist and shuffle them, you get the full statement. I don't think you can get either album without hearing its mate. And a lot of people, I think, missed out by only listening to the John Lennon album. Can you talk a little bit about the Plastic Ono Band, what the concept was, and how they collaborated in those projects?
Okay, so there's a whole chapter on Plastic Ono Band, okay? A whole chapter about each album, every song, but also a chapter on the band members as they evolved, you know? So the first one was, I guess, you know, the Toronto, Live Piece in Toronto, when they assembled quickly. And the band, the concept was Yoko's idea. She was asked to do a concert in Berlin. She imagined having a plastic band on stage with her. So on the sleeve for Give Peace a Chance, you see those four clear plastic objects with a microphone and a tape recorder and a TV set. So those kind of refer to the Fab Four, you know, four pieces. Or the TV set is an homage to Namjoon Paik, who was famous for the TV sculptures. And so that was her little concept. And you know, the band, of course, was the first with Eric Clapton and Klaus Voormann with Toronto. And then Ringo joined with Klaus Voormann for the POV albums. And then actually in 2010, Sean revived the Plastic Ono Band name for Yoko's birthday concerts in the city and kept them for her next few albums. So, yeah, there's a whole list of people who were in the Plastic Ono Band.
Yeah, and that concept of having a flexible group of collaborators that come and go as they're able to. That was just something that was in the air in the rock and roll world. Crosby, Stills, and Nash were obviously trying to do that, but got pinned down into a supergroup. And Plastic Ono Band, they managed to stay free. It was always John and Yoko, but everybody else came and went. And in fact, on her Plastic Ono Band album, there's a collaboration with Ornette Coleman, Charlie Hayden, and David Eisenson and Ed Blackwell, two drummers. Charlie Hayden, the bassist that played with Coleman through most of his most famous works. And Coleman's playing trumpet on the song AOS. Tell us a little bit about that collaboration and how it came together.
So in early 1968, you know, Coleman invited Yoko to perform just like one show with his band at the Royal Albert Hall. And they did a piece called Emotional Modulation. Well, the evening was called Emotional Modulation. That's how it was advertised. And the piece, Yoko calls it AOS, A-O-S. And she combined, I asked her about this. She said it was the Japanese word AO, A-O, which was the word for blue, the color. And O-S was from the English word chaos. So she, together it was like blue chaos. And she didn't confirm this, but I'm thinking it was kind of a pun on Miles Davis' album title, Kind of Blue, because she felt, you know, she was in the jazz realm now. But basically, she just did some vocalizing. She stipulated that it had to be her own piece and not theirs. And she scored it without any notation. She wrote words telling what the musicians should play. And it was things like, think of the days when you had to suffer in silence for eternity before you would give, and then you were afraid to give. And it was all this emotional turmoil that she wanted to get out of the influences. And then she wanted some silences in there. And she's like, this is no mood or whatever you call it. It's real. Forget what you learned in the music world. So it was just her thing. And then it was a rehearsal for this that was recorded and ended up on her Yoko on a Plastic on a Band album.
And it's a really incredible collaboration and gives a totally different feel for how musicians coming from a completely different place than the rock and roll world that Lennon and his collaborators were coming from interact with Yoko and her music. So yet another tradition that's, you know, just as alien from what she was doing as rock and roll is. So I love hearing that compare and contrast, but also definitely cats who are able to throw down with Yoko at her own level and match her for her intensity. And now let's play our final song snippet. This is one from the 80s that actually had quite a bit of success on the dance charts in the US in the 80s. This is Yoko Ono, Walking on Thin Ice. That was Yoko Ono, Walking on Thin Ice, one of the last songs that John Lennon ever played on. And we're skipping a lot of stuff. We're skipping over the long weekend when Yoko sent John Lennon away for 18 months with May Pang, the Sometime in New York City album, which features their collaborations with Frank Zappa's band and also the Plastic Ono supergroup from the Lyceum concert, and a number of stuff. But I want to get to the death of John Lennon and Yoko Ono's, how she dealt with that, both music, especially musically. How did she confront and express her grief publicly in this horrible period?
Oh, well, right after she just kind of had to hold herself up in the apartment because she was listening to tapes of John's songs being played outside her window. Imagine, I mean, it's unbelievable. And she had to deal with telling Sean about it. She didn't tell him until the next day, had to show her child where this happens and how, and you know, it was a nightmare. So she was quiet for a while. She dealt with the funeral aspect of it by making it a vigil of silence, and thousands of people gathered, right, of course, underneath her window. And she began hiding under those sunglasses that actually John had chosen for her. Maybe he knew something, maybe he didn't, you know, and she was wondering why did he choose these? He said, you should wear these all the time now. So they kind of protected her. And she didn't really emerge until 6 months later. Well, she went into the studio right away and started recording Season of Glass and finishing some songs that had started together and adding others. And of course, the album cover reflects the nightmare through John's glasses with blood on them. It showing what the world had done to him and to her. And, you know, she says, you know, she saw a floor with a pool of blood. That was a mild expression of what she saw, you know, and she's amazed that people felt that she was exploiting him. She felt like, you know, this is what he would have wanted to say, like, this is what you did. So, you know, the songs on there are very poignant, some are beautiful, but there's just an element of glass through the whole record. It's just fragile, shattered. It's beautiful, actually.
Yeah, it's a really powerful album. And that was a period of time in which a new generation of alternative artists, the B-52s, come to mind, obviously, as, you know, people who had grown up on Yoko's music and had been influenced by them. And so there's a whole counter narrative emerging of people who were fans of Yoko Ono, who got what she was doing and were extending it. Talk a little bit about that and how she interacted with the new wave and the emergent dance club scenes.
Oh, well, she eventually, like much later, ended up having hit singles on Billboard's dance club charts. And she would go into the booths with the DJs and dance and provoke, and she was in her glory because John had said that Walking on Thin Ice would be her first number one, and she couldn't believe it when it actually happened.
It made it to number one on the U.S. dance charts. And I guess we do have a little bit more time to talk about the Double Fantasy album, which they collaborated on after taking 5 years off to raise Sean together. Talk about that collaboration and how they worked with Jack Douglas together in the studio.
Okay, so Double Fantasy was, of course, their emergence from seclusion after raising Sean, who's now like 5 years old, and he, you know, he didn't need to be so closely watched anymore. So they emerged and they did this dialogue of alternating songs. And of course, hers are more constructed at this point. There's none of really the avant-garde stuff. But she loved this album. Like when on BBC, they asked her, which album would you save if you were on a deserted island and it was being washed away? And she said Double Fantasy. So, you know, it comes out with like Hard Times Are Over, right? It's a new beginning. And it's just so sad to listen to it after the fact, you know, but it was a brilliant album. It was very hopeful. It was truthful. There were songs about everything on the album. It wasn't just for a pop album, you know. Ja had said that it's for everyone that's in his age group now, with they have kids now and they have settling into adulthood and conflicts in relationships and songs about their son and love songs. It had everything.
Yeah, and it becomes her most popular work in the wake of his death. It's a massive bestseller. And because it alternates John and Yoko songs, I think the fans were forced to confront Yoko. And I think a lot of fans turned around on Yoko around this time once they saw the dignity which she carried herself as, you know, the most famous widow in the world. And the suddenly, you know, her husband's been martyred and the way she dealt with that. And it's also been interesting to watch her over the decades since then, as she has basically fought John's corner in the various legal and political and artistic struggles within the Beatles empire. There's been various lawsuits back and forth. She's handled those with aplomb. She's really emerged as a force, as a business person, and as the manager of Lennon's legacy, continuing to make movies very recently. A recent movie I found really inspiring and interesting, that made very clear how much of a role she played in the creation of Imagine, and that Lennon actually said that he felt he should have given her a co-writer credit in retrospect.
Right, and she did get that, you know, finally. They credited her. They played a tape of him saying this, you know, so that was great. And so now she's co-ed. She has a little award. They have given her awards now about the co-writing on that.
Yeah, and I think that's long overdue. And you know, so much of the positive image of John Lennon was around his role as, you know, an advocate for peace. And she was definitely his partner in all that. And there's so much more of the story I wish we had time to get into. But it's been great talking about Yoko Ono with you, Madeline. The book is In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. My guest has been Madeline Baquero. So thanks so much for coming on and singing a song that's not often sung in this world. And that's the song of Yoko Ono.
Right, thank you. There's so much to learn.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate welcomes Howie Abrams to discuss Joseph I, aka HR and the Bad Brains. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.